wasn't until like 2 years after I left that I even Googled the church for fear that they would like track my internet usage or my computer history.
She's definitely right. There is a fear that stays there. There's a sort of a constant paranoia that persists for years after you're involved.
Two young people who grew up as Scientologists. We'll talk to them about their experiences and why they eventually left the church. But first, as Cherry just mentioned, Carly Fiorina is the latest candidate to enter the race for the Republican presidential nomination. Here she is today on Good Morning America announcing her campaign.
I think I'm the best person for the job because I understand how the economy actually works. I understand the world, who's in it, how the world works. I understand bureaucracies, and that's what our federal government has become, a giant, bloated, unaccountable, corrupt bureaucracy. I understand technology, which is a tool both to reimagine government and to re-engage citizens in the process of government. And I understand executive decision making, which is making a tough call in a tough time with high stakes for which you're prepared to be held accountable. I don't think you read about that. You learn it by doing it.
Neurosurgeon Ben Carson also announced his candidacy, and Mike Huckabee expected to do the same tomorrow. The 2016 presidential race is on track to be the most expensive ever, $100 billion. The Supreme Court has struck down a lot of the rules that used to limit how much money political campaigns can raise, but there are still few of them left. The only problem is that the Federal Election Commission, the agency responsible for upholding those rules, is really no longer able or willing to enforce them. At least that's what the Democratic chair of the FEC told the New York Times in an article yesterday. She was quoted as saying, "People think the FEC is dysfunctional. It's worse than dysfunctional." The reporter she spoke with is Eric Lischblau, and he's here now. Welcome.
Thanks for having me.
Well, Anne Revell, the chair, she said that. What does she mean by worse than dysfunctional?
Well, what she meant was that you have an agency, the Federal Election Commission, that's just trapped in perpetual gridlock. There are six members of the commission, and by mandate, there are three Republicans and three Democrats. They've been able to work together at times over the past years of the agency, but the last 2 years on any significant vote, it ends in a 3-3 tie, and what she was saying is that she sees really little hope of that changing between now and the 2016 election, and she has really no hope of cracking down on the abuses that she thinks are widespread in campaign financing.
Why has it gotten more partisan lately?
Well, I think it's partly a matter of personalities on the commission. I think it's also partly a matter of the Citizens United decision that the Supreme Court handed down in 2010, which was a huge win for Republicans in terms of opening up corporate spending in ways that had not been allowed before, and really validating the Republican ideology on campaign finance. And so that's had the effect of really emboldening Republicans. They feel like the law is on their side, at least from the Supreme Court, and the negotiations that we might have seen before just aren't as necessary anymore because they can always come back to Citizens United and say that our way is what the High Court has blessed.
Right. So bears noting that the Republican commissioners don't think that the agency is dysfunctional.
Right. I quoted one of the Republican commissioners as saying that we were set up to gridlock. That's the way Congress invented us 40 years ago, and they are perfectly happy to not approve, to block investigations when it comes to political groups. There were a whole series of cases involving whether groups like Karl Rove's group, Crossroads GPS, should be treated as political groups or not for purposes of disclosing who they raise money from. And the Republicans voted as a bloc not to approve those investigations moving forward, and the Democrats voted to approve them, and they came out in the short straw by virtue of a 3-3 vote.
So if, from the Republicans' point of view, it was set up to gridlock, what was it set up to do then?
That's a good question. I mean, you really have this philosophical stalemate over what it is that the FEC is supposed to do. It's been known for a long time as one of the more dysfunctional agencies in Washington, which is saying a lot by Washington standards, but it seems to have really hit its absolute depths in terms of how little is done on significant votes. And It ends up just being sort of talking points from each side and nothing done at the end of the day. Certainly, I think people in Congress that approved the creation of the agency 40 years ago, right after Watergate, you know, they saw this as at least potentially an agency that could be a check on abuse and illegality, the type that we had seen in Watergate. But that certainly has not happened lately. And in fact, if you look at the fines that the FEC issued last year, it was one of the lowest levels in years. It was a drop-off about 75% from just the year before in terms of fines that they're issuing against campaign finance violators.
So since Citizens United, there's been this flood of campaign money into presidential campaigns, and yet we have two candidates who have yet to declare, Jeb Bush and Scott Walker. It's common knowledge that they want to run for president, and yet they haven't said those words. And by doing so, though, they are able to raise a lot of money.
Sure.
How is that allowed?
Well, and that's actually one of the issues that the chairwoman and Ravel pointed to in complaining about the almost lawlessness in campaign finance is the fact that numerous candidates, she didn't name names, but certainly Jeb Bush and Scott Walker would be two of them, that numerous candidates appear to be skirting, if not breaking the law, by raising tens of billions of dollars without declaring themselves, not even as candidates, but as possible candidates. So what the law says is that once you are officially testing the waters, meaning you're throwing your hat in the ring and saying, I might be interested in running for president and raising money, you're then subject to certain restrictions and disclosure laws, and you have many candidates, both Republicans and Democrats. Martin O'Malley is one on the Democratic side who's been holding all sorts of fundraisers without declaring himself a president, who appear to be on the other side of that law. And that was something the chairwoman has been quite upset about.
All right. So are there any rules left? And if so, who's going to enforce them?
Well, are there rules left? Yes. Even after Citizens United, there are still some significant restrictions in terms of how much individual candidates can take in corporations. While they're free to give to PACs and outside groups and spend their own money, they are not free to give to individual candidates. PACs are not allowed to coordinate with individual candidates. Maybe the most important is that nonprofit groups, which have taken on a much greater role in politics, once they reach the status where most of their organizations are devoted to politics, they're supposed to disclose who they get money from and how they spend it. While the law has certainly been loosened after Citizens United, there's still a number of areas that are designed to promote disclosure and checks and balances on how money is raised. Who is enforcing that? The answer is no one. I mean, as the FEC chairwoman told me, there's really little likelihood that the FEC is going to be in a position to guard against abuses. And the feeling, at least in the Democrats, is that this has been basically issued a blank check to campaigns and political groups to do as they please.
Eric Lischblau, reporter for The New York Times. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
All right. We'd love to know what you think. Is the next election just going to be a money free-for-all? Have the rich and powerful, though, always had their say and ways to figure out how to make their say known? Call us 1-844-PRESSPLAY, or you can reach out on Twitter or Facebook at KCRW PressPlay. All right, so that's a peek into what happens after the money's been spent. But where is the money coming from in the first place? Well, since the Supreme Court's Citizens United decision in 2010, the money is increasingly coming from individual donors, which means that donation bundlers in Hollywood aren't the big fish they used to be. Jessica Levinson is an election law expert, professor of law at Loyola Law School. Hi there.
Thanks for having me for Money and Politics Day at Press Play.
Well, you're very welcome. It's great to hear you. So first of all, give us your take on this, on what Eric just said about the FEC basically ceding all oversight over campaign finance laws.
So in the interest of full disclosure, Ann Rabl is a friend of mine. I met her through working on these issues, and I think that she's absolutely right. I mean, the FEC was designed for gridlock, but Eric has a fantastic article in the New York Times, and he details that while it's long been dysfunctional, it's never been this dysfunctional. For instance, he talks about the number of fines that have been levied have plummeted. I mean, he has this anecdote, which is silly, but it's emblematic of what's happening in the FEC right now, is that they can't even agree on whether to serve donuts or bagels. Now, at that point, you can
pretty
much...
Which one's the left and which one's the right on that?
This is an embarrassing moment, but I am not educated enough to know. I will call Anne and tell her that I was not adequately prepared. It is true that when the FEC gridlocks, the default is no action. So whenever there's what I think I would believe in many cases absolutely rises to the level of something of probable cause, you know, are some of these 501c nonprofits that Eric was talking about, at what point do they become political committees where they're not really charitable organizations, they're actually political committees? That's absolutely something that should be investigated. But when it deadlocks among party lines, nothing happens. And yeah.
Does it mean for the individual campaigns themselves? Do they just become shells for these nonprofits and for these big, you know, political groups?
So that's a great question. And that's kind of, I think, what we're talking about in terms of the bundler, the Hollywood bundlers. Are they losing their power? Well, I think in many respects, the candidate campaigns, and, you know, that's once the candidates actually become candidates as opposed to just claiming they're not candidates, well, they actually are, they're kind of in the shadow of the super PAC campaigns. And the super PACs sometimes are funded by these nonprofits. So, yeah, in certain circumstances, I think it's not how much can the candidate raise. It's like, you know, I picture the candidates kind of running around this circle of musical chairs, and it's like everybody grab their billionaire before you have to sit down, and you don't want to be the one who's, like, not holding hands with the Koch brothers when the music stops.
Yeah, in fact, they are auditioning candidates in a strange sense, or they've said that they are going to wait and see who they like before they decide who gets their nearly $900 million that they're planning on spending in this cycle.
Yeah, so, you know, people are going to vote in Iowa and they're going to vote in New Hampshire. But, I mean, sadly, I think we have those primaries, but then we have these wealth primaries. We have some people call it the Koch brothers primaries. Or, I mean, we can also talk about liberal donors, you know, George Soros, Tom Steyer, Michael Bloomberg. But increasingly, there's this wealth primary that happens where this is the top 1% of the top 1%. So these people who are deciding basically which candidates are going to be competitive and what we're going to talk about. If George Soros thinks that something is important, you can bet that Hillary Clinton is going to address that at some point in the campaign.
She will be here this week attending some fundraisers. And so talk about her place in Hollywood and how much money she can expect to raise here and the level of the support here for her.
Well, the Hollywood money, I think, is not going to dry up for her. I don't think that, and I'm being very general here, but, I mean, in terms of the, you know, Stephen Bochco, Haim Saban, David Geffen, Jeffrey Katzenberg, I'm not really concerned that they're all of a sudden going to say, you know, I don't think we took a look at Ted Cruz. Or, you know, I don't see Jeffrey Katzenberg saying, Marco Rubio's, you know, got some points here. So the money is going to go to her. I think the question really is just enthusiasm and power. So these are players who used to be big bundlers. So they would say, you know, the federal maximum now is $2,700 per person. And they used to say, here's your check for $270,000. And they used to be pretty big players. Now, you know, if George Soros can say, here's your check for $270 million, all of a sudden their importance wanes a little bit. Now, I think that this next election is going to be so expensive that people won't be choosy. Everyone will want their billionaire. They will want their super PAC. And, you know, in the case of Hillary Clinton, it's Priorities USA. But they will also want the Hollywood bundlers. And she's certainly not saying to the people who are throwing her fundraisers next week, oh, you know, don't worry about it. I'm just going to be fully funded by the super PAC.
Right.
You know, another thing she's doing is The disclosure reports are going to come out, and she wants to say, I raise money from small donors too. So I think they're trying to flatten the model so that people like me will say, hey, I gave $25, and she'll say, I have this broad-based support.
Well, yeah, and so what's happening to that? Because that famously is what Barack Obama counted on in his first election, were lots and lots of small donors. Is that now not the storyline for this election?
I think it's going to be, it will certainly be part of the storyline. Now, whether it's part of the reality of how someone gets elected, I'm not sure. I mean, Obama was brilliant at this because he got just as much, if not more, big money from big donors. He just broadened his base out. So in addition to those big donors, he also had the $25, $10 donors. And so I think it's a really important part of the storyline to show support, to show it's not just the top 1% and the 1% that supports me. I think it's going to be a major talking point when the disclosure reports come out. Look at all of these working class, average people, you know, all the people who showed up in Hillary's video, all of these people support me. But in reality, you don't win a campaign that's going to cost billions of dollars on the backs of, you know, $25 donors. So I think it's an important part of the story. The reality is, in this era, you need your super PACs, you need your bundlers.
Jessica Levinson, professor of law at Loyola Law School, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Coming up, how HBO has become a documentary filmmaker's paradise and why TV lost in the Mayweather-Pacquiao fight. Our TV critics are here next on Press Play.
Take KCRW with you on one of our smartphone apps. Available for the iPhone, Android, and BlackBerry. You can stream KCRW live, listen to podcasts, and all our news and music streams. Learn more and download at kcrw.com/apps.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand.
And there's the Mayweather right hand, blocking Pacquiao twice. Knocking it back into
well, as you may have heard, there was a boxing match over the weekend. Floyd Mayweather defeated Manny Pacquiao in the so-called fight of the century, and more people tuned in than expected. HBO and Showtime had exclusive rights to the match. The cable channels charged customers $100 to watch it, but many viewers pirated the fight. For more on this and other TV news, I'm joined now by Michael Schneider of TV Guide magazine and co-host of KCRW's podcast, The Spinoff. Hi, Michael.
Hello, Madeline.
And Liz Shannon Miller is here now. She is TV editor for IndieWire. Hi there.
Hi, how's it going?
Good, thanks. All right, so Michael, this pirating, was it widespread?
It was pretty widespread, actually. So you mentioned that HBO and Showtime had exclusive rights to pay-per-view. Well, turns out they didn't, because anyone who had a phone could basically put it in front of their screen, and a lot of people did. There are these new social media apps called Periscope, also Meerkat, but Periscope is the one that's owned by Twitter, so it's got much more penetration among users. And now you can live stream video basically anytime, anywhere. So on Saturday night, a lot of people were sticking their cameras in front of the TV screen and essentially live streaming, live broadcasting the fight. So anyone who hadn't plopped down $100, anyone who had a phone could watch it.
Did they not see this coming, HBO and Showtime?
Oh, they absolutely saw it coming. But, you know, this is such new technology that no one quite has figured out how to wrangle it just yet, put their arms around it. So, to some degree, HBO is used to piracy because, as we know, people pirate their HBO Go accounts all the time. And they sort of, for years, have looked the other way. And now, so far, they're sort of looking the other way with Meerkat as well and Periscope, although they experienced this a couple weeks ago with the season premiere of Game of Thrones and sent a letter to Periscope saying, get your act together.
Okay, well, speaking of Game of Thrones, let's move on to it. Last night, there was a subplot involving a gay character, and he was imprisoned as part of a revenge plan. Here's a clip.
You and I both know how the world works. Too often, the wicked are the wealthiest, beyond the reach of justice. The king himself cannot always punish those who deserve it most.
All sinners are equal before the gods.
What would you say if I told you of a great sinner in our very midst, shielded by gold and privilege?
May the Father judge him justly.
Ooh, okay. The evil queen, Cersei, and she's creating an army of religious fundamentalists there. And Liz, what do you make of this plot line?
Well, it's a fascinating moment for the show because while gay characters have always been a presence within the show itself, this is the first time we've seen religious attitudes towards homosexuality become explicitly part of the text, and in a way that they're not even... That's not even done in the books, which is one of the many changes this season from the original George R. R. Martin novels. But what's fascinating about it is, you know, we have a character who's literally thrown in jail for being gay. Gay being codified as a sin within the world of Westeros, that, you know, almost makes the show feel more modern just in terms of the fact that it, you know, the people of this country are dealing with the same issues that people in our country are dealing with. It's a slightly different scale.
So are we to take away from this that this is a commentary on modern politics or just, you know, good drama?
I mean, it's hard to tell at this point because of the way that this is the reason for this action is much very tied into, you know, the evil Queen Cersei's grab for power.
Mm-hmm.
So that it's a very hard thing to define at this point, but it's going to be really interesting to see how it affects the rest of the season, especially the way we watch it, because right. We don't watch anything in a vacuum anymore.
Yeah, yeah. And so how are fans dealing with the fact that this is the first season that is not taken from the books themselves?
I think from fans, I've heard a mixture of excitement and concern. I talked with one friend recently who was saying that this is the first season where he doesn't know what's going to happen. He doesn't really like it. He's very, very nervous about being in the same place that we've been in all these years.
Yeah. Okay. So last night was the season finale of The Last Man on Earth, the Will Forte comedy in which he plays the last man on Earth. Here's a clip.
Mm-hmm. Hello, Carol.
Oh, hi, Tandy. Isn't it a wonderful day?
Yeah. So, Carol, is there anything you want to tell me?
Tandy, what are you getting at?
Well, Carol, I'm getting at this. You know what this little number is?
It's a condom wrapper.
It's an open condom wrapper with the condom inside conspicuously missing.
Hmm.
You know where I found this?
Going through my garbage?
So you admit to having sex with Phil?
Darn tootin'.
So I guess he's not the last man on Earth.
He is not the last man on Earth. So you need to move past the title. It's a cute title, but it's not at all representative of what this show has become, which is, it's really an experiment in comedy on television. It's like unlike anything else we've seen on TV, and there's more twists and turns to come. I'm not going to give away anything from the season finale, but they set up possibly a whole new direction for the show in season two. It has been renewed for a second season. And if you haven't seen it yet, binge it because it's worth checking out.
So it started out with a lot of critical praise, and did it live up to that praise?
I mean, it definitely took a turn somewhere in the middle of the season as, you know, new characters were being introduced and people were kind of grappling with the fact that what was so appealing about the show initially was the concept of, okay, they really went for it in that first episode. They really had an entire episode, which was just Will Forte on screen and dealing with his situation. And now, and then when that changed, people, I think, started having a lot more problems with the show. But since then, I think... What it's evolved into is something interesting on a level beyond that first episode.
Yeah, it's interesting to some degree. You know, halfway through the season, people started saying that Will Forte's character was really unlikable and it was harder to watch. But then the show came around once again. So this has been an interesting, almost roller coaster ride to watch how critics and viewers react to this show. They've been up, they've been down, but I think they're back up again.
Okay, let's talk about documentaries. HBO finally airing the Kurt Cobain montage of Heck movie, and this comes after Going Clear and The Jinx, so they're really on a roll when it comes to documentaries.
They are killing it right now. Now, to be fair, HBO's always been killing it with documentaries. Sheila Nevins, who heads up that division at HBO, is the most awarded person in TV Academy history. She's got more Emmys than anyone else, and I think she's going to pick up a lot more this year as well because it's just been a string of huge successes for her.
Are people tuning in? Are the ratings good for these documentaries
have been great. I mean, the Scientology documentary was hugely rated, and of course everyone was talking about the Robert Durst series.
Mm-hmm.
And
the
this
Jinx.
Yes, yeah. The Jinx, and this new one is great as well. It's a side of Kurt Cobain that we still haven't seen, and by the way, we've never heard from his parents, his family, and they are a big part of this documentary and why this thing sings.
But it does show that you need to have a sexy topic. You know, I mean, all three of these are pretty sexy topics.
Yeah, we get the screeners for HBO documentaries all the time, and HBO has a huge field of documentaries, and some of them are much more quiet and tiny, and, you know, the kind of stuff that you get used to from the documentary field. But they are getting these blockbusters, which helps elevate the whole area.
Yeah, and documentaries in general are huge right now on television. You've seen CNN do a lot more of them. You've got networks emerging like Pivot that are doing a lot of documentaries. Oprah Winfrey's network has really done a lot of docs lately, too. So it's big overall, but HBO, of course, is still leading the pack.
The real takeaway for me is the fact that television in general is just a platform for all sorts of content, no matter, you know, whether it be like documentaries that play at film festivals or, you know, your standard sitcom fare.
Yeah. And in these particular instances, the not including The Jinx, but these two others were theatrically released as well.
Yeah, exactly. So, you know, HBO kind of goes differently depending on the material and where they release it first. So HBO's not only an Emmy stronghold, but it's also an Oscar stronghold.
Michael Schneider of TV Guide magazine and co-host of KCRW's podcast, The Spinoff, and Liz Shannon Miller is TV editor for IndieWire. Thank you.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks a lot, Madeline.
Coming up, what it was like growing up a Scientologist. I speak with two young people who were born into the church and made the difficult decision to leave. That's after a news update with Eric Roy.
Listen to KCRW's 24-hour all-news channel. Stream BBC World Service, NPR, and KCRW programs. Continuous coverage and accessible via our smartphone app or online at kcrw.com.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. Going Clear, the documentary on Scientology, has brought the church a lot of unwanted attention. It's a highly critical look at the origins of Scientology and its current practices. The movie relies on the recollections of members who've left the church to talk about what went on behind closed doors, people who spent years, decades even, in the church. But the movie did not explore what it was like to be born in and grow up in the church, to be a child in Scientology. I spoke recently to two young people who were raised as Scientologists and then left. Carol, not her real name, is the daughter of a celebrity. She's 17 years old. And I spoke with Bob, also a pseudonym. He's 23 years old. Because his parents weren't as wealthy, he had a different experience. And so, Carol, you grew up in Scientology from, you were born into it.
Yeah, I was born into it. And my family is also like, my dad's side of the family, everybody is in the church.
So you're second generation.
So I'm a second generation.
Or a third even.
Yeah. I think it's this thing where they were like saved by it. They were like picked up and nurtured by it. And then my dad was obviously born in it and living in Hollywood. It was just like a really integral part of his life.
And did he ever question it?
He has questioned it. I think there were certain times like, when he was in his 20s, he was working a lot and he dated some women who weren't Scientologists. So I think he floated away for a second and then came back and eventually married somebody who was also a Scientologist.
And your parents were also in it?
I think it was my dad that got into it in the 70s, and he got my mom into it when they met, and they were in it for 30 years.
So you also were born into it.
Born into it, yeah. I actually had family that was Scientologists, that were Scientologists.
And did you go to school in special Scientology schools?
Yeah. They don't call it that, though. If you call it that, the teachers will get very cross with you because they front as just a regular secular private school. People send their kids there not knowing that it's a Scientology school.
But do you learn boarding schools, too?
Yeah. Oh, yeah, there are boarding schools. I knew kids that went to boarding schools.
So you didn't go to Scientology schools?
No. I went to private schools in L.A. So there were times where people were like, what is Scientology? Or like, you don't take medication when you're sick and stuff like
that.
And
would you defend it?
I didn't know what to do because I didn't know why anybody would be against it when I was a kid. I always had like very positive experiences. In fact, I felt like I was almost treated like a princess like my whole childhood. I think because my family's prominent in Hollywood, that like the church protected me and shielded me from just like what Scientology really is, or like I didn't meet anybody who wasn't really wealthy. Like the Celebrity Center has like a totally different section for people who are wealthy or famous. So you go through a separate entrance, and the place in the Celebrity Center is called the President's Office. And you walk in and there's like a buffet, and the people who've been working there have been working there for, it's like the same two people in that office like my whole life. And then there's a stairway, and your auditor can come down to the waiting room. You're like sitting there watching a movie or eating, and you go upstairs, and there are specific auditing rooms for friends and family of famous people, so they don't have to be bothered by the general public. And when I was doing processing there, I was doing a certain step on the bridge. I wasn't clear yet. And that was such a huge part of my experience in the church. Like, I was nannied by the women who, like, worked there at times. Like, my dad would be in session, and I was a kid, like, coloring in the president's office.
Let's pause right here. We want to take a moment to define some Scientology terms. Auditing is one of the methods by which one gets clear, that is, attains a state free from what the church calls the reactive mind. And with auditing and coursework, church adherents move along what they call the bridge to total freedom. Carol did most of her coursework and auditing in a special area in Scientology's Celebrity Center in Hollywood. I assume, Bob, you never went to that section.
No, never went to that section.
Did you even know that there was this separate thing for celebrities? And
it seemed apparent that there were special places you couldn't go, you know.
Mm-hmm. It seems to be based on a lot of hierarchy. There's getting through various
I mean, one of the
steps, and
one of the core things that is essentially worshipped in the church is power. I mean, one of the conditions, I think one of the highest conditions you can have in what they call your different conditions of, is it beingness? What is?
Yeah.
Okay. Is power.
It's like, how power can you make the most money? And like, they essentially teach you how to build a business. It's almost like business school.
Yeah.
So as a child, what are you taught?
Well, I imagine you and I were taught different things a little bit.
Yeah.
Like, my parents didn't tell me I was a Scientologist at first. I mean, maybe when you're 3 years old, you don't ask, you know. But then it became clear to me that, like, the other kids at the playground and everyone was all kind of talking about this thing, like we were all part of it. And so I asked, and like they showed me who L. Ron Hubbard was, you know, and they spoke about him as if he was this just ubermensch. But I just got a very bad vibe off of it. But you can't say that. And that's one of the first things really that you learn, is just what you can't say. And you just progressively internalize it, you know?
Yeah, I knew that we were Scientologists, but I didn't know how small the following actually was. I also, like, didn't really realize what it meant to be a Scientologist.
How much time would you spend at the church, and what did that entail? Because, as you say, you went to a regular school, not a Scientology school.
Yeah, I spent a lot of time there. I would say I went there at least 6 days a week.
After school.
After school. And I was going to very competitive private schools. So there were points where I was like, I have too much work and I can't come. And they were like, just do your homework here. And it was like 5 hours of homework and then 3.5 hours of coursework.
And what is this coursework? What does that entail?
So L. Ron Hubbard wrote a lot of books. So I started when I was 8. And you read the chapter and then you fill out worksheets. And it's $50 per course, but at the pace that I was going, I would do like 2 courses a week.
So you were spending 2 or 3 hours a day after school on this, mm-hmm. on top of your other homework.
Yeah.
Spending $100 a week?
Yeah, like $100 a week. But then on top of that, I would do seminars like on the weekend where you like hear a lecture and then do a course on that in like one night. Or you, like, I did the purification rundown. I also was having auditing on top of my coursework, like once or twice a week. And the auditing is really expensive.
How much do you think your parents paid for you to be, to grow up in Scientology?
My mom told me that there was a certain amount of money that they put on account when I was a kid. And it was like $250,000.
Just for you? $250,000.
For my mother and I, but she didn't do as much as I did.
Wow. And did you have to pay a lot of money as well, or your family, Bob?
Well, there wasn't really enough money to go around for us to all be involved. My mom actually worked at the school so that I could go there. To go to those schools, at least for other parents at the time, it was costing about $50 a day for what is essentially a Scientology curriculum under a different name.
Would you learn regular stuff, or are you learning mainly L. Ron Hubbard stuff?
They have all of the subjects that they are required to by law. You do it the same format as a Scientology course with all the study technology, as it's called.
This is Applied Scholastics.
Applied Scholastics, right. Yeah.
And just to be clear, Applied Scholastics is a company that provides educational materials and services based on the teachings of Scientology's founder, L. Ron Hubbard. You mentioned that you did a purification ritual.
So I did the purification rundown.
Purification rundown.
Yeah.
What is that?
So they encourage it for every Scientologist to do to become clear, but it's also used for people who have been on drugs or like people who have been exposed to chemicals. So for the purification rundown, you sit in a sauna for like a certain amount of hours, and it becomes like
hours?
5 hours a day.
In a sauna?
In a sauna.
Without a break?
No, you get breaks, but you take like the vitamins that you're supposed to take, and then you run for 20 minutes on a treadmill to start sweating so that the niacin will start working in your system. And then
they make you take an insane amount of niacin, by the way.
Yeah.
Like how much?
I don't know, but it makes you have a crazy skin reaction. Like, yeah. You basically get a sunburn and you sit in the sauna, and then
after you've run, you sit in the sauna.
Yeah. And you get as many breaks as you like, but you start at like a low amount of niacin, a low amount of hours, and then it gets more and more as you hit certain markers or whatever on your rundown. So you write every day what you're experiencing, and then you come to like your final end phenomena. And that's when you stop experiencing the sunburn from the niacin and you stop getting headaches. Like, I had terrible migraines, and so they just told me to take more and more potassium, and then I was sleeping, like, a ton. And
how long was this?
And I think it was a month in the end.
And how old were you?
I was 12.
So after that month, what happened to you physically?
So if you don't hit the end phenomena, you have to keep going. And it costs more and more. So I was also going on course at that time and basically spending all of my time at the center. And that's with everything you do in Scientology, you have to hit this end phenomena. And they encourage you.
And
they
what
tell
is that?
You
how do they
what it
measure
is.
That?
So they tell you what it is before you do it. So you can say, I hit this end phenomena and now I don't have to do this thing anymore. So
did you do it too?
I didn't do the purification rundown. Some of my family did, and they too seemed to be going through the ringer physically for a month, around that amount of time. But there's this thing in Scientology called no case gain, and there's a very heavy stigma attached to it within the community. Basically, if you don't get end phenomena, if auditing doesn't work for you, if the courses don't work for you, you don't have a win, as they would put it, you're deemed no case gain, which means that you are likely a suppressive person and immediately stigmatized and ostracized from the group.
And if you meet a Scientologist, they're happy. Their whole thing is like thriving and prospering. And it's really hard if you're not doing well, because then you're seen as somebody who should be ostracized.
Speaking with two young people, Carol and Bob, pseudonyms, who grew up in the Church of Scientology. We'll hear more from them in a moment. First, though, let's find out what's happening in the next hour at 1 o'clock on To the Point with Barbara Bogave. Hi there.
That was really interesting.
It was.
I'm going to have to switch gears, though, completely to GMO foods. We're talking about Chipotle, swearing off, taking food off the menu that contains GMO, genetically modified ingredients in their food. And also a general trend in big food towards healthier and more sustainable practices.
Although, is there any scientific evidence that non-GMO foods are healthier?
As usual, you have hit the nail on the head, Madeline, and we will be talking about GMOs and the preponderance of evidence that it is both safe for humans and the environment. However, there are some issues, and we'll get deeply into them, as is our want unto the point,
yes.
In the larger food chain and food supply, and also how decisions like this in big food in America have a ripple effect across the world.
Right. Okay. Well, fascinating, and I know our audience loves this topic. So,
yes.
Definitely tune into that on To the Point at 1 o'clock. Coming up, we're going to continue our conversation with Carol and Bob, how they chose to leave Scientology. That's next on Press Play.
Take KCRW with you on one of our smartphone apps. Available for the iPhone, Android, and BlackBerry. You can stream KCRW live, listen to podcasts, and all our news and music streams. Learn more and download at kcrw.com/apps.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. We're talking with two young people who grew up in the Church of Scientology. Carol, not her real name, is the daughter of a celebrity. She's 17 years old. And Bob, also a pseudonym, is 23. He was a middle-class kid from the suburbs. So how did you decide to leave the church?
I mean, it had been kind of driving me crazy the whole time a little bit. But you can't raise questions that people don't want to answer. And the reaction that they have to you is kind of aggressive and very dismissive. So I think when I got to the point when I felt that I could no longer identify myself with them was that I had a friend who was my age, 14 at the time, and her family went to Florida so that her mother could do courses at FLAG, which is a base they have in Florida. Where people go to get very advanced training. And she was not in school at the time because, as you may have picked up on within Scientology, there's a stigma against public education. They see it as mills for psychiatric zombies, and they tell you your whole life, like, you should be really glad you're here because if you weren't here, you would be being pinned down to the floor in your school and they would be shoving all this Ritalin down your throat to, like, get you to conform to the psychiatric agenda. So I had a friend who was just cooped up in her mother's apartment in Florida, and she was getting suicidal, and she was not eating. And I had been aware that there were people who couldn't talk about their situation because you're not allowed to be weak and be a Scientologist. But actually seeing it happen, it just made me sick. I don't know.
And so at that point, you thought?
I thought, I don't feel ethical pretending to be this just so that I don't have to get in trouble.
Hmm. It was so that must have been hard.
It was. I am fortunate enough to have two older sisters, one of whom had left and not spoken to us in almost 10 years.
Because she didn't want to be associated, or because your parents didn't want to be associated with her?
Because my parents would have told people where she was living, and she had a right to not have to worry about that.
So your parents would have sided with the church?
There were times when they were protective of us because there was always the threat of the sort of circling school of sharks that was Sea Org recruiters who are at these Scientology schools and who show up at the houses of Scientologist families to try to get the kids to sign away the rest of their lives.
And Sea Org is the group that does all the work, the sort of menial labor.
Yeah, you sign a billion-year contract, and while you're in the Sea Org, you get all free processing, and if you choose to leave, you have to pay off that processing. So you're working, like, all day and then doing your processing. So,
how did you decide to leave, Carol?
I wasn't doing well. I needed support, and I didn't have any friends in the church. I never had any peers in the church, and my friends outside of the church had talked about, like, the South Park episode or, like, what they had read online. Like, people asked me what my beliefs were, and I didn't know how to describe what I believed.
Did you know the whole story of Xenu and...
No. People said aliens, and I said, no, don't talk to me about that. that's not true. I've never heard that before. And most Scientologists have never heard of that story before. Because you're told that if you read about it or hear about it, then you won't be able to progress on your bridge. And when you've put so much money into it, it's really hard to say, okay, I'm going to do something that could risk all the work I've done.
I was told I was going to die of pneumonia if I read it, if I read Xenu. Possibly get
if you if you found out about the origin,
yeah.
Because you knew from the other planet who,
yeah, because sometimes you do hear about it. I mean, I had heard a little bit about it, but every time, even just like a waft of it came up in the conversation, it was immediately shut down by any adult that was nearby. You know, that was a lie to bring down the church and discredit the church, but also that, you know, you're not allowed to know that stuff because that information is really dangerous. If you're not ready for it, it will ruin you on the bridge, and that's, since that's the only scale of spiritual success that exists, you're just kind of messed up forever.
I was told that, so black PR is what they call what people say about the church in the media. So I was told that those were rumors made up by a morbidly obese and sick man who really wanted attention. And I hadn't seen anything on the internet because I was afraid to even Google search my own religion, right? So eventually it was almost like there was an intervention with my school where I needed help and I got the help that I needed. And
is this mental health help?
Yeah.
Because they're anti-psychiatry.
Yeah. I didn't see a psychiatrist. I was not allowed to even say that word, but I got the help that I had been asking for, and I felt like I had to separate myself from my family to a certain extent.
So what was your dad's reaction when you said you're going to leave Scientology?
So my family, since they are well off, they're protected from this idea of disconnection. If my family was following what Scientology actually says, they would not be allowed to talk to me.
And what about you? Your family's not protected. So when you said you're leaving, what did your parents do?
Well, I remember the first thing was my mother called my name from the other room. And she says, get in here, close the door. So you're not a Scientologist anymore. This creates a pretty big problem for me, you know? I guess it probably did create a problem for her because my family for a while was being pestered by people, many of whom were their friends and colleagues, about my condition. My mom tried to prevent me from being able to contact my sister who had left. And she had me have a long talk with her auditor friend. And then from that point on, they were just very angry with me for a long time.
So how are you now that you're out of it and you have this different perspective? Have you been able to move on?
I'm doing really well, and I've made strides to make my life the way I want it to be. But it's definitely difficult. You know, I thought, okay, like, I'm over it. I have moved on. It doesn't bother me anymore. But I there's fear instilled in me still. So I think the main thing that has come out of it that has been negative is that I still, it wasn't until, 2 years after I left that I even Googled the church for fear that they would, track my internet usage or my computer history. Other than that, I think my family is really, I'm so lucky because my family is supportive of me even though I'm not in the church. So I've grown away from it.
And how about you? Are you away from it? Are you okay or not?
I am away from it, and that has been a very good thing. I don't really have any connections with anyone who's still involved, and that's my decision. That wasn't forced upon me. That was what I needed to do, and it's good. But she's definitely right. There is a fear that stays there. There's a sort of a constant paranoia that persists for years after you're involved.
That's Bob and Carol, not their real names, two young people who grew up in the Church of Scientology. Carol is off to college in the fall. Bob, who's older, says he didn't go to college because he couldn't find one that would take his school credit. He says his parents have now also left the church. For its part, the Church of Scientology denies many of the claims made by Carol and Bob in this interview. And to see the church's entire response, go to our Facebook page, KCRW Press Play. Julie Myers is here now with the listener feedback. Hello.
Well, more than anything, I just want to point our listeners to give us feedback today on what they heard. You can reach us on our Facebook page where you can find that response from the Church of Scientology. We have a blog post that's linked there. Plenty of conversation going on Twitter as well. A lot of people are very shocked by what they just heard. We want to hear your opinions as well, so feel free to weigh in all of the various regular ways that you usually find us.
Absolutely. All right. Well, thank you for that, Julie Myers. At KCRW Press Play is our Twitter, KCRW Press Play, the Facebook page once again. To the Point with Barbara Bogave is coming up at 1 o'clock, so keep it right here. I'm Madeline Brand. Have a great afternoon. I'll see you tomorrow.